Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekday mornings at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Catherine Richard, filling in for Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. So there's this conversation I know I need to have with my seven-year-old, and I'm actually dreading it. I'm not talking about the sex talk. That one actually seems pretty simple. I'm talking about the climate change talk. I know that as an adult, when I see headlines like 2019 capped world's hottest decade in recorded history, or Australia fires will be normal in a warmer world, I know I get a little bit anxious. I don't really know what I can be doing to have an impact and reduce my footprint. So for my curious, passionate, and anxious kid, a conversation about climate change could very well be panic-inducing. Today, we're going to learn how to talk to our kids about climate change in a way that's real, but not terrifying. We're going to be hearing tips of things you can do with your kids to be good stewards of the environment, and we're going to be learning how to empower the next generation, not paralyze them. And I want you to join the conversation. Are you a parent who has good tips on talking about climate change? Is your kid experiencing climate change anxiety? And how are you helping them handle it? Or are you an educator who's teaching kids about this issue? I want to hear from all of you. You can call in at 651-227-6000 or send me your questions on Twitter by tweeting at Kat Richert. That's CatRichert. And joining me this hour to answer some of your questions are Susan Clayton. She's a professor of psychology and environmental studies at the College of Worcester in Ohio. Thanks for being here, Susan.
Oh, I'm happy to join you, Catherine.
And we have Mary DeMocker. She's the author of the book, The Parent's Guide to Climate Revolution, 100 Ways to Build a Fossil-Free Future, Raise Empowered Kids, and Still Get a Good Night's Sleep. Thanks for being here, Mary.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
So to get this conversation started, Susan, I want to ask you this question. Why is it important to talk to your kids about climate change?
Well, I want to start by saying that kids, one of the things kids really need is a sense of security. And so what you've said is clearly you're reflecting the concern that children's sense of security is threatened by climate change. But children also need a sense of security based on sort of social trust. And so they need to trust the society, and they need to trust you as their parents. And if they feel like they can't get the straight story from you, you know, that can really be a threat to their sense of confidence and stability.
So, Mary, in your experience, how honest should you be about climate change? Should you protect them a little bit, or should you be really forthcoming with facts about it?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. I think it's important to be honest, no matter the age of your child, but I would also make that information you give them age appropriate. So for younger children, I would keep that a little more like a concept about protecting our earth, and here's what we're doing to be inclusive of everyone and respect wildlife or care for the environment. And I wouldn't necessarily give them a strong tutorial in climate science or tell them all of the things that I know that are frightening, but to cultivate in them a sense of understanding that we have a crisis, we have a problem, but we're working hard on it, and we can work together in our family, and we can do it through engaging in things in our own home, or we can work on the civic level. And I have lots of ideas about how we can do that. But I think it's important to be honest, but also but also not tell the whole story like you were saying.
Yeah, and I'm going to go back to Susan. One thing that I think about a lot when I'm talking to my kids about this is whether there's any danger in lying to your kids about climate change or just sort of brushing that conversation off. I imagine, you know, getting to sort of the middle school, high school level when they're talking about this in science class, that could be sort of a shock for them. What's the danger there?
Oh, absolutely. I think that it is a risk when you lie to your kids that can undermine their sense that they can trust you in the future. Now, and I want to echo what Mary was saying, though, and say there's a line or there's a difference between kind of telling the truth and telling the whole truth. And depending on the age of the child, you know, you don't want to hit them with more than they can handle in terms of how scary this is. And you started by talking about your own anxiety. I think it's really scary for a child to feel that the parent is terrified. So you want to put a brave front on it, I think.
Yeah, and Mary, going back to what you said earlier about, you know, particularly young kids, I'm wondering if you have any tips about framing this issue in sort of an age-appropriate way for slightly older kids, too. Any thoughts on how you would talk to, like, say, a tween or a preteen teenager type?
Sure. I think the older they get, the more appropriate it is to bring in more of the science. And if you're just bringing it up for the first time, no matter what the person's age is, your child's age is, you can give it a kind of a basic sketch of people are doing things that are polluting the air, and that rises up and it creates kind of a blanket around the earth, and that's heating the earth in ways that are causing some problems. So no matter what the age, you can kind of give that basic outline. But whenever you're talking about the climate and the crisis that we're facing, which is very real and very large, you want to give them information as they ask for it, and then also empower them and connect them in solutions.
So this is just a reminder to our audience. We want to hear from you today. When did you start talking to your kids about climate change, and how did you frame that issue to your 5-year-old, your 8-year-old, your 12-year-old, and what was their response? We want to hear from you. You can call in at 651-227-6000 or send me your questions on Twitter by tweeting at Kat Richert. That's CatRichert. So we have a caller on the line. This is Arthur in New Hope. Arthur, what is your comment or question?
I guess I have a comment. I'm a high school teacher, and I'm a history teacher, so I'm not as exactly a science teacher, but the subject of climate change does come up occasionally. And what I'm aware of through my experience and through co-teaching with other people in the building is that we have climate change deniers on our staff that will provide misinformation to students, so that they might be getting one message in one classroom based on science and another message in another classroom based on politics. And it's really frustrating. I do have a co-teacher who actually in class challenged my assertion about the science of climate change with a political argument. And with a room full of 11th graders, it's hard to stand there and have a back and forth with a person like, well, I'm sorry, but the science doesn't actually support that. Well, this one EPA commissioner back when says that climate changes, and it's like, well, there's always this one person. It makes it seem like there's a debate.
Right, Arthur, you're raising such a good question, and I was actually going to bring this up later for both of our guests, but Susan, I'll throw this to you first. I mean, I think a lot of us have had an experience in our life where our kids are hearing mixed messages from two adults or three adults that they really trust, right, on this topic. So how do you navigate a situation where maybe a grandparent or someone older in your kid's life is telling them that this simply doesn't exist?
Right, and I think Arthur's example illustrates how this disagreement among adults whom you trust can have the potential to undermine children's trust more broadly. So if you have two teachers in your school telling you different things, how do you know who to trust? And you might kind of become disillusioned about the whole educational process. I would say ideally, at least in a school setting, maybe there could be some general conversation about, here are the standards we're going to use. Here's going to be our standard of evidence, and maybe we'll let the science teachers talk about science and, not have a debate in front of the students or things like that. At a family level, of course, it's much harder, but I'm probably not the only one who has, said them to my children about, Grandpa. So I think you might not want to challenge the other voice head on, but you can, especially for many children, they don't have to be that old, you can kind of provide them some context and explain, yes, people disagree, here's why they disagree, but here's why I feel confident about what I'm telling you.
Right. And Mary, how do you navigate this situation, maybe even in your own family, if this exists?
Well, I agree with everything that Susan just said. I think it's important to put out that virtually all scientists on the planet, climate scientists, agree that humans are dangerously heating the planet. So when you come from the point of, you know, science and talking about what's fact and what's scientific consensus, it's, there's not a lot that you can argue with in terms of logic. And on the family level, I don't actually experience it very much in my family because I have a huge family that agrees in general. But we do sometimes have arguments with extended family or neighbors, and I tend to actually dodge arguments. I say we have arguments, but I actually don't encourage those kind of conversations. I make a statement basically saying, here's what the scientists that I trust say, and until they tell me that I don't have to work full-time to make sure my kids are safe, because we are safe at this point, then I'm going to keep doing the work that I'm doing, and I hope that you'll join me because I know that you care about my children too. So I come from a place of caring and trying to establish an authentic connection with the person who is maybe has been misled by a very robust misinformation campaign by the fossil fuel industry for two decades. So I understand that there's a lot of information that's not true that's out there. It's been put out intentionally, and it's had an impact. So I don't want to attack the person who's been kind of a victim of that misinformation, but try to reach to them through, here's what I know to be true, and here's what I'll be doing, and I invite you to join me.
Great. So we have another call on the line. This is Lynn in St. Paul. Lynn, you have kind of an interesting way to talk to your kids that you teach about renewable resources.
Yes, I am part of a program called Kid Wins, and that's kidwin.org. If parents are familiar with something like Lego League, it's similar to that. We build wind turbines, solar structures, so we learn all about the wiring and the volts and the ohms, the energy produced, and we compete it at a competition. And there will be a state competition coming up in April, and then there's a national that happens, I believe, in June. And some of the stuff we do is, for instance, when we talk about wind turbines being offshore and that they're ugly, I don't give the kids my opinion. We look it up. We research it. We walk down a long hallway and we stand right next to somebody and say, how big are they? Oh, they're really big. And then you walk back so many feet and you hold your thumb up. And the person keeps getting smaller. And we talk about how wind turbines offshore have all these benefits of decreasing storms and producing energy, and can you really see a big wind turbine 25 miles offshore, and how ugly really is it? And then the kids form their own opinions. Some think it might not look great, but most are like, yeah, that's not a big deal.
Yeah. Lynn, I want to throw a question out to our guests here off of your comment. I'm wondering both Susan and Mary, and we'll go to Mary first, what are you seeing being taught in the classrooms that's really creative and innovative to teach kids about climate change? What techniques are working?
Well, I think that the caller's techniques are perfect when you raise the question and then you let kids go do some research and you empower them to do their own critical thinking and you talk about it together and you take the time to look at the pros and the cons and see what the larger picture is. So I love that example that she just gave. I think that kind of putting it out to young people and working on the question together is really empowering for them.
Susan, have you encountered anything that's particularly creative or unique in the classroom?
Well, I want to pick up on the word that Mary used of empowerment. I think that there are teachers who are doing things that are getting students involved to not only find their own answers, which is really important, but in fact potentially get involved in addressing the problem. And this can be so important in as a way of helping them get over a feeling of hopelessness and to see that there are things they can do as individuals, but even perhaps more importantly together, you know, and maybe it will be they're going to, for example, work to change the policies in their own institution. You know, some student groups have come together to say, well, we need to, I don't know, get our school to have solar panels or reduce our energy use or, you know, maybe have more vegetarian options in the cafeteria, those kinds of things.
Great. We have another caller. This is Simeon in Savage. Simeon, what's your question?
Hi. Yeah, I want to speak to the challenge that parents and their kids have and not so much to the solutions because the solution my wife gave last night was great, but I'm interested to hear your angle. So the challenge, just last night, my wife went up past our kids' bedtime to check on him, and our oldest is 8, and he's emotionally and developmentally, he's pretty on the normal range in the bell curve, but he hadn't gone to sleep. He had tears in his eyes because he said he couldn't get his brain to stop thinking about stuff, and he wanted to get his brain to think about something else, and he just couldn't get his mind off of these things, and it was hard for him to put it into words, but he shared with my wife how he was thinking about volcanoes and natural disasters, not in those words, but other natural disasters of that type.
Yeah, Simeon, this is a really familiar story for me as well. Mary, how often do you hear stories like this? And what's your advice for a parent like Simeon?
Yeah, I hear this all the time. It's heartbreaking, and it happens in my own family. And I think the most important thing to do when children express fear of the future, fear of fires, or sorrow, intense sorrow about koalas who were, you know, burned alive in Australia. That kind of information is readily available to our children now. And I think it's important to really listen to them, to take the time to sit and validate their feelings and acknowledge that we're in a crisis and offer them solutions when they're ready. So first you need to explore the feelings, and Susan can speak well to that, I'm sure, from her point of view. But for me, that listening and validating is key. And then my part that I'm more expert at is, where do we go from there? How do we engage with children in the solutions that are actually commensurate with the problem at hand? And that, to me, is that you facilitate their engagement in the solutions that are actually going to have meaning. And those can be at home, but more and more we need to be starting to look at how to change the system, the larger problem. And one of the ways we can do that is to tell them, look, there are lots of people who feel the way you do, and there are lots of people working hard on this problem, and we can join them if you want to join them. A lot of them are young people, and you can connect them to who those young people are, like Greta Thunberg. And she's been inspiring so many children, millions of children worldwide. So I think it's important to first, you know, in two steps, listen, validate, really understand what they're afraid of. Sometimes they might need something as simple as for you to listen, but then maybe they need a family evacuation plan in the case of a fire, for example, or maybe they need to be part of raising money to help the koalas. Find out what it is they're worried about, and then connect them with some ways they can engage positively and feel empowered.
Right. It seems like there's some therapy in the simple act of doing something, whether that's making a plan or contributing money. Susan, how would you tackle this situation?
Yeah, this example just reminds us that kids are worried, and we see this, you know, in more representative samples as well. There is a lot of anxiety there. And one thing that I've heard young children say is that sometimes they feel they can't talk about their feelings, that they feel that they have to pretend that they're okay, or they feel that their fears are not being taken seriously. So as a parent, even though you might want to say to your child, oh, it's nothing, it's much more important to listen to them and reassure them that their feelings make sense. And then, as Mary was saying, try to get them to reorient their thoughts to the future and to positive steps that they can take, either to get involved or to help protect their own households, or maybe even just remind them of some of the positive aspects of engagement with nature, that it's not all about gloom and doom. But I do want to just note that, I mean, sometimes kids do need therapy. Sometimes they could benefit from a little bit more intensive conversation focused on their mental health.
We're going to take a quick break here for news, and when we come back, we're going to talk more about those practical steps that you can take with your kids. I'm Catherine Richard, and I'm filling in for Carrie Miller today. This is NPR News. If you're just joining the conversation, we've been talking about how you can talk to your kids about climate change. And to help us navigate these tough questions, we have Susan Clayton on the line from Worcester, Ohio. She's a professor of psychology and environmental studies at the College of Worcester. And we have Mary Demacher, author of the book, The Parents' Guide to Climate Revolution, 100 Ways to Build a Fossil-Free Future, Raise Empowered Kids, and Still Get a Good Night's Sleep. And I want to hear from you. How are you talking to your kids about climate change? And as an adult, are you experiencing climate change anxiety? And are you struggling to shield your kids from this too? You can join the conversation by calling 651-227-6000. And you can find me on Twitter by tweeting at Kat Richert. That's CatRichert. So, Mary, one thing I liked about your book is that it offers some practical tips for families who may be very busy or don't have a ton of money to throw at this problem. And one suggestion that I thought was so interesting was this idea of rethinking the pressure many parents may feel to do something like club sports on the weekends. So talk to us more about how we can reframe the way we see our day-to-day to have an actual impact.
Yeah, I think it's important for us to understand that our own actions make a difference, and so we can have day-to-day impact, and things like especially food waste has become more and more of a culprit in the climate crisis. So that's something that happens at the level of 40% in the United States. We waste 40% of our food. So learning about that and finding ways to be part of solutions where you're reducing food waste or you're composting your food waste. So that's one thing we can do at home. But in terms of lifestyle, I think it's important to understand that the lifestyle that I'm often talking about is our impact on the civic level, our impact for system change, not just for changing our light bulbs. So that's what the book is really about, is how do we wrap civic change into our day-to-day lives? And there are lots of ideas for how we can not necessarily do more, which can be so overwhelming for parents and families, but to do the same things that we're doing and do it in new ways.
So Mary, talk to me a little bit more about this idea that parents are actually in a really good position to network around climate change. I thought that was a really interesting point in your book as well.
Yeah, we have so many relationships. By the time we have kids that are in school, in particular, we have neighborhoods that we're part of. We have pediatricians and dentists. We have a school community. We often have a faith community. We have an extended family. And all of those people are on board with us as parents in trying to make their lives better, in trying to love those children and protect them and consider their well-being and all the things that we're all doing together as part of the extended community of care around our families. So one of the things I talk about is using that sphere of influence and talking about your concerns with all of those other adults who love your children and want to be part of creating a good future for them. So that's one of the places it's important to start, is just with people who already care about your family. So on the soccer sidelines, you can bring up that wind power is the cheapest kind of energy on the planet. A lot of people don't know that. You're on the sidelines talking anyway, so maybe pivot to your concerns about climate and solutions that you know about. So to take those opportunities with your pediatrician to say, I'm worried about my child's asthma, or I'm worried about their long-term health. What are you doing in your role as a medical professional working with children to ensure that they have long-term health and clean air? So really starting to use those relationships and talk about the well-being of children and not being afraid to bring up your own fears and the reality of the climate crisis that we're in, and that there are solutions that we can all be working towards.
So we're getting a lot of calls and tweets from parents and teachers who are talking about just getting outside. Brian called in earlier. He's in southern Minnesota. He said, I'm a farmer. And so our conservation has some interesting dynamics. We're seeing changes on our farm due to the environment. Another parent wrote in just saying, hey, I'm taking my kids outside a lot. And we also have Jane in Duluth on the phone. You're an environmental educator, Jane. Tell us more about that.
Yes, I've been doing this work all my life, both as a volunteer and then I finally did it through grad school. And the single most important thing I think we can do, and I learned this for working with kids for 35 years and having delightful fun with them, every chance we got, we go outside. And going outside and connecting with nature is natural to children. It doesn't cost anything. You don't have to invest in anything except maybe some nature guides. I just can't press this enough that we are losing our connection to nature, and nature and the ecosystems it provides. That is our health and our wealth. We can't fix it if we don't begin that basic scale. When I was in grad school, the most profound thing I remember was one of my teachers who'd studied cross-cultural kids at the age of 8 to 10 and how they went to the woods to play. And he said, we have got to quit sending this message to our kids that they have to save the world after we've cleaned it up. He goes, we teach them to love the world. When they have a connection and a love to the natural world, all these other things begin to fall naturally in line. They don't have to be fear or frightened or pushed. It's just part of, you know, I made friends with my chickadees at my feeder. I want them to keep being there. Just simple things like that. Get the kids and parents outside. And if you know elders who have like a farm or a outdoor place, they have great stories. They can teach you so much about the outdoors.
Yeah.
And support your local nature centers and places like that. It's so simple and easy. It's, to me, the easiest place to get started and have fun.
Jane, I really want to get our guests to weigh in on this too. Susan, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what the science says about, you know, getting outside and how that can be good for us, but also instructional, like Jane was talking about.
Absolutely, and I'm sure the caller knows some of this. There's so much evidence about the benefits of spending time outdoors for kids. For one thing, it just comes naturally to them, and for the younger kids, you know, it gives them a time to move around where it can be very difficult for them to sit in their desks in the classroom. It's natural, you know, nature is naturally engaging. So you go outside and there's all kinds of things to look at. You can watch the leaves change, you can look for bugs, you can experience the weather, and you have the benefit, too, of running around. And spending this time outside is not only kind of good for their mental health, but it has, I think, two additional benefits that are relevant to our conversation today. One is it teaches them something about how to get information and how to pay attention, how to notice the kinds of changes that are happening to the natural world. And if they go outside often enough, they might even begin to think, yes, from their, you know, very short time perspective, yeah, it does seem like we've had unusually warm weather or unusually dry weather or whatever. So they're learning how to pay attention. But perhaps even more importantly, as the caller was saying, it teaches them to care. Because if they don't experience the natural world, it's very difficult for them to really care about it. But when they spend time out there, it becomes personally relevant. And so they'll be motivated to do more to protect it.
Mary, what are your thoughts on that? I'm sure you're getting out often with your kids, too.
Yeah, we are nature lovers, so for us it came naturally just because we love to be outdoors and we're out in Oregon, which offers so much beauty. But we also, right from the start with our children, were immersing them in nature so that they could also just be happier. It's wonderful to connect with nature in multiple ways, and we made sure to do that through sending them to camps and taking them to the park and just sending them outdoors. You know, we're lucky enough to have a backyard where they had a sandbox. They had unstructured, you know, child-led, unstructured playtime. And I know that there's more and more research about how important this is for them to have time to just play without adult intervention or without a structure like, you know, little league soccer and such that has little, you know, young children really having to follow these rules and having all this structure that's kind of tiring when you're very young. So we did a lot of unstructured time and gave them the tools for that. So that was a bucket and a spade and maybe some blocks if they were indoors. Or I mean, I'm thinking now about the imagination. So I'm kind of segueing to child-led fantasy play indoors, outdoors is very empowering for them because it allows them to create stories and build whole worlds, which is important for really where we're going, is that they're going to have to be able to imagine the world that they want to create and then have the tools and the practice of building that, whether it's tree forts outside or sandcastles or democracy, ultimately. So I think nature play is an important part of that.
Right. So just connecting. We're getting a lot of calls and a lot of tweets on Twitter, but I want you to join the conversation by calling 651-227-6000, and you can tweet me at Kat Richert. That's CATRICHERT. Next, we're going to take a call from Becky in Cold Spring. Becky, tell us how you talk to your kids about climate change.
Hi. Yeah, we drive past a landfill on my way to the grandparents' house, and our children are 5 and 3 at the time, and they noticed the smell, and we talked about that's the smell of a landfill, and why it smells bad is because our garbage goes there when we throw it away, and that part of our garbage is the food that we waste. So we talk a lot about food waste in our family because it's something that kids can see. They eat all the time, right? And they leave food on their plate. So we try to only make as much as we need, and we talk about if we consume what we make and on leftover night, if we eat what we've made before, that it might not be our favorite thing to do, but it's reducing our carbon footprint because the energy that was used to make that food is now consumed and not just thrown away to go in the landfill and make that bad smell. So we just try to connect it full circle.
Yeah, Becky, you raise a really good point and one that I'm thinking about too as my kids get older. Mary, you write about this as well. I mean, at what age does it become a great idea if your kid's really passionate about this? At what age do you start talking about, you know, going to climate protests, for instance, versus these like smaller things that you might just be doing on a day-to-day basis with your kids when they're younger? What is the best way, in your opinion, for kids to have a real impact on this issue?
Well, first, the what age for protests. We took children to protest when they were young. I don't think that's a bad idea. I think there are a lot of family-friendly protests in this day and age, and protests are a fun way for kids to actually run around and make noise. They're very good at doing that when they're younger. And we feel that taking children to protest is a natural extension of our care as a family for the planet. So we're doing all the things that we're doing, whether it's biking or recycling or composting, but we're also talking a lot about stewardship, about caring for the planet, about caring for the animals, and civics is a natural extension of that. We are asking the people that we've hired to represent us to also be good stewards of the planet by making laws that are respectful of the earth and that keep toxins out of our waters and that stop fracking operations from starting in our community. So I think it's important to wrap civics in right from birth for children in a way that's relaxed and fun and empowering. So we weren't having them out there marching. We were going, and we would invite them to go as they got older. So in other words, when they're young, they come with us because that's what the family's doing today. And when they're older, it became an invitation. So I think civics all the way through. And in terms of the second part of your question, you know, what age can they start really making an impact? I feel that it's important to look to them to lead that. Some children are fired up in second grade to be part of a larger conversation because they're maybe more extroverted or more passionate about the issue. Greta Thunberg started being passionate about the climate issue when she was 11. She had enough understanding of the problem to really start researching it, and she actually became deeply depressed. So for her, the thing that changed everything for her was starting to do her strikes when she turned, I believe, 15. So I think it's important to let the child lead in terms of what their interest level is and then guide them in what kind of action is right for you. How can I help you speak out? And we as adults are so connected to the larger world and an understanding of how systems work that we're the perfect people. We know our children. We know the larger community and how change is made, and we can help them.
Yeah, you know, Greta Thunberg has come up a couple times in this conversation, and I know for a lot of people she's an incredibly inspiring person, especially for younger kids who are concerned about this. But she can also be a little bleak sometimes, and I'm just wondering if there's anyone else out there who's modeling good conversations about climate change that our kids can be looking to.
Yes, Earth Guardians is another group. That's led by, it's an international group. It's led by Shateska Martinez, who is a young indigenous hip-hop rapper. His form of activism with his family is wonderful and inspiring. He's, I think, 18 now. Another group is the Sunrise Movement. That's for older, the tweens and teens, the older kids who are looking up to the college and high school age. There's a lot of engagement now in civics with the Sunrise Movement. There's also on the Juliana plaintiffs. That's through our Children's Trust. And they are 21 children suing the federal government for their right to a livable planet. And they're doing films, and they have there's a lot that you can plug into. There are ways that you can join into those campaigns that aren't necessarily the student strikes.
Right. I want you to join our conversation. You can call 651-227-6000. And you can find me on Twitter by tweeting at Kat Richert. That's CatRichert. And you know who I really want to hear from? I want to hear from some kids. Are you a teenager who's involved in climate change efforts at your school? Are you working on activism around this issue? We want to hear from you. That's 651-227-6000. Or on Twitter, at Kat Richert, that's CatRichert. So while we're waiting for those calls, Susan, I want to flip the script here a little bit and ask you about tips you have for talking to people in older generations, at least, you know, sometimes in my case, my baby boomer parents, about climate change, and particularly people who don't necessarily believe in it. How do you approach that situation?
Well, One thing to avoid is to make it a win-lose situation where you only win if they lose. You only succeed in convincing them if they back down. And instead, try to find ways to talk about something you agree about. So maybe you agree about how important it is to protect human health and how health can be threatened by extreme weather events. And, you know, maybe there are things we could do to reduce the likelihood of these things happening. Or maybe we agree on teaching our children to love nature. A lot of, you know, very politically conservative people nevertheless love and value the natural environment. Or maybe it's about I want to reduce my energy usage to save money. You know, so let's talk about how we can save money by cutting our energy costs. So that can be one approach.
And I'm also wondering, I've seen you quoted a few times talking about the use of emotion in these conversations. How do you use emotion effectively when you're talking to adults about this, deniers?
Well, here I would say it really depends on your audience, because some people, when it comes to climate change, some people are not scared enough. And so you probably need to it will be useful to scare them a little bit. I think people need to feel, many people need to feel a greater sense of urgency than they do now. So talk about some of the evidence and the bad things and tell stories about particular places or that were harmed or that are threatened. But other people, and this is obviously one of the bases for our conversation this morning, other people are too scared. So I don't think it's a good idea, especially children, but even adults. If you're too scared, you're not going to have an adaptive response. You're either going to go into denial or you're just going to be paralyzed. So, you know, judicious doses of hope are also really important. And returning to a comment Mary made a minute ago, fun, that we should find ways, especially for children, but even for adults, find ways that working to protect the environment can be fun. Getting together with other people for a protest, for example, can be a really positive experience with lots of shared good feelings. So that's another emotion that perhaps we should be highlighting a little bit more than we have been, that sort of happiness of engaging in fun activities together.
So we have a call coming in from David in St. Paul. You're at school right now teaching. Is that the case? How do you deal with this issue in your classroom?
Yeah, I'm an elementary school science teacher in St. Paul, and I've for quite some time been really concerned about how to present this to kids without scaring them, but also be able to provide some solutions for them. And so recently I had a volunteer from Al Gore's organization, Climate Reality, come in and present the kids a little one-hour presentation. And as a result of that, we came up with a program that I'm calling the Climate Change Action Bank, and it's been quite successful now. And what the kids do is they first generate a list of actions that they can take that will reduce CO2 emissions. And so even in that process, they get a lot of information about the science. And then they provide tickets for them with point values assigned for these various actions. So, for example, if they recycle, you know, they get 10 points or 50 points or something like that. If they drive the speed limit or some of these things that are very simple. And then at the end of a certain period of time, a couple of weeks we've been doing this, the kids then exchange, they present these tickets that they've earned to their parents. And their parents then are given an option to provide actual real dollars to programs that actually are proven and vetted to reduce CO2 emissions. And it's been very successful. Parents have been very receptive and very grateful that they have an opportunity or a way to actually do something. And the kids have been absolutely fantastic about it, too. They're very, very engaged. So, you know, I just wanted to share that. I think it's been very successful. Maybe somebody else can try something like that.
Yeah, David, you raise a really good point, which is that it seems like the kids are actually teaching their parents. Mary, how effective do you think that approach is?
Oh, it's very effective. And I know there's been research on teaching climate science to middle schoolers and empowerment, and that they've found that more and more of the parents are becoming involved, even if they're starting out as climate deniers or conservative, that being engaged by your own children in these issues is very effective for helping people understand that the science is in, there's already a consensus, and here are some solutions that your kids are actually teaching you. I think that's wonderful, this program that your caller is describing, because it does exactly what I'm talking about in my book, which is using the existing spheres of influence that we have as young people or as families to just have a more robust conversation about the causes and the solutions, more importantly, to this crisis that we're all seeing play out in real time, you know, in our world already.
I want to remind you, you can join our conversation by calling 651-227-6000. And you can find me on Twitter at Kat Richert. That's CatRichert. We have Tom in Hudson, Wisconsin on the line. Tom, tell us about what it's like to teach environmental teaching to teachers.
Thanks for this topic. I really appreciate you having it. I'm part of a Minnesota nonprofit foundation. It's called Jeffers Foundation, and our sole purpose is environmental stewardship and professional development for teachers. And we have a philosophy that how can we really expect kids to take care of this beautiful earth if we haven't taught them how to love it? So our organization does free workshops, no cost for materials or workshops, called Team Teaching with Mother Nature. And we get into schools all across Minnesota, teaching them how to take children outdoors, sensory perception kinds of activities, observation skills, questioning skills, inquiry, and then reflection. We use a journal approach, and we give them a wealth of activities. We call them eco-time activities, which are simple activities to take children outdoors, some of which are about your very topic today, and some are just about engaging in the earth, and it goes beyond science. It's not just the science; it's the social studies and literacy and art and music. And so, I really would encourage schools to think about how are we taking children outdoors. I think that's a first step before reacting to climate change, is making sure that they do understand the beauty and the joy of our earth.
Right. I think what I hear you saying, Tom, which is really interesting, and I'm going to throw this question to Susan, is that part of this is really just teaching our kids how to be critical thinkers, right? And to see the connections between disciplines that might actually have nothing to do with each other, or seemingly nothing to do with each other. How important is that critical thinking aspect, Susan?
Oh, well, it's fundamental. And I think, as the caller illustrated, that it's much broader than just addressing the climate issue. It's something we really want our children to develop, but we can actually utilize their concerns about climate as a kind of entry point for developing these more critical skills. So because they're, if they are already interested in climate issues, you can take that as an opportunity to get them to learn how to collect evidence for themselves from the natural world, for example, or to critically evaluate perhaps different political arguments if they're slightly older children.
All right. We have Eric on the line in Minneapolis. Eric, talk to me about how you're talking to your kids about this.
Well, we were really upset by climate change, so we decided to just be super positive that humans have always solved problems. And actually, we found it's been an incredible blessing because we eat really healthy because we try to not buy processed food and plastic so it doesn't go in the oceans. And then we just flat out stop buying any kind of junk toys. And now the kids do really cool things like play with jacks and make stilts, and they have a couple little woodworking tools, handsaws and hammers, and they make all kinds of stuff. And we're all a ton happier, and there's a direct connection because we don't want to mess up the planet. We love the animals, and so it's actually been overwhelmingly positive, and the kids just love it.
Right.
That's my only thought.
And Mary, this kind of gets back to your idea that this is like a full-on lifestyle where you have to be thinking about it in sort of every single thing that you do. Any comments on his approach to teaching this to his kids?
I think it's wonderful, and I think it's inspiring for children when their adults are kind of leading them on a program and leading them in solutions. I do want to say that I don't agree that we necessarily have to have it be part of every single thing we do. I actually think we need to take breaks from it and not expect ourselves to wrap it into every single aspect of our lives. So I actually present these ideas as kind of a menu for families, and they can pick and choose what works for them. Sometimes we need to just take breaks from it. And I think it's important to know that we're not going to do it alone. We're not going to do it as a family. We're going to have to do it together. And again, that means system change. And I think just to speak to another thing that your caller talked about is, you know, happiness. The all the things that we're doing for climate are also good for families, especially children who are still in these smaller developing bodies. So what's good for the climate and the air is good for our lungs. So fossil fuel burning is really toxic for our bodies and kills millions of people worldwide every year. But if you shift to clean energy, you're really shifting to a much healthier environment for all of us everywhere.
We have some really great comments coming in on Twitter. Bethany says, if you need help talking to people about climate change, @NNOCCI has some great resources. They even have free training on their website in using metaphor to help people understand how climate change works. Sarah says that her first grader has talked about climate change in science class and that they can't wait until middle school. At home, they talk about proactive things they can do in their house, like solar panels and reducing waste. You know, I'm really interested in some practical advice as we get close to the end of our show here. Mary, any online resources, any additional books that you would recommend parents check out on this topic?
Yeah, I think the book Drawdown is a wonderful resource, especially for older children and teenagers and adults. It's 100 different ways that are scientifically proven to draw down the legacy carbon in the atmosphere. So slashing emissions is important, planting trees is important, and locking carbon into the soil is going to be key in the coming years. So that book is it's a little bit of a coffee table book, so I would recommend that.
Holly in Lakeville called in to recommend the book Strong Girls for a Green World. Susan, back to you before we wrap up here. Any specific websites, books, any sort of practical advice you'd leave with parents on our way out here?
Well, the Children and Nature Network, which you can find online, has all kinds of resources. A lot of it is academic, but not all of it, sort of directed towards the importance of nature in children's lives and how to make sure that happens. And I just wanted to return to the point that there are benefits. I hope people are not just thinking about talking to their kids about climate change as an unpleasant task that they somehow have to do, but a lot of people find that making these kinds of changes, whether it just be talking about social issues with their children and getting them involved or finding ways to get outside more, really have positive impacts on their family life.
Thank you both so much. Our guests have been Susan Clayton. She's a professor of psychology and environmental studies at the College of Worcester in Ohio, and Mary Demacher, author of the book, The Parent's Guide to Climate Revolution, 100 Ways to Build a Fossil-Free Future, Raise Empowered Kids, and Still Get a Good Night's Sleep. Thanks to both of you for being here. This is NPR News.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. You can add your voice to the discussion by calling in at 800-242-2828 or tweeting us at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. To hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks!